Rob Wolf here with Greg Everett, back for episode 72 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what the heck's going on?
Pretty typical Friday stuff with the addition of a lot of rain.
Yes.
Again.
I could go outside and just look in the sky and drown myself, basically. and I'm right. Very tempted to do so.
Let's save that till we're done with this one. Let's at least get 72. You're now two episodes shy of matching the number of performance venues.
Ooh.
So you at least got to catch up there.
Nice. There's some good synergy there. We need to have some sort of a performance menu Paleo Solution party at some point.
Yes.
And then I can walk outside and drown myself because it's just pissing sideways in Northern California. So
by then, I won't try to talk you out of it.
Perfect. Okay. Good call. So nothing else new, exciting, dramatic?
Not really. We're trying to bang out this new DVD. Just a lot of tedious work and not enjoying that, but it'll be great once it's out and I'll be happy to be done with it.
So what's the proposed or theoretical timeline on that?
Spring 2011.
Perfect. That's sufficiently vague.
I'm not taking any grief from you about timelines for projects. You were supposed to do that book like 14 years ago.
Well, yeah, it's probably better I waited a little while, but yeah, that's true. That's true. I definitely set the bar low on that one, so it was not difficult to improve upon my projections with the book. But hey, we got one done, so.
Yes.
So we should use maybe the Rocky theme as an opener for today because we've got a training-themed podcast today. Greg sifted through all of the tailings, and pulled out some great questions related to training specifically. So we're going to shift gears a little bit away from food specifically. I think we might have a little bit of food-related stuff in here somewhere.
There's definitely a bit of paleoism still involved.
Okay, good, good.
So we're still holding on to that thread.
We wouldn't want to send people into a fizz, but we're going to talk training today. So
yes.
Yeah.
All right. So, first one. Ken says, "Hi, guys. I've been doing the Strong Lifts 5x5 program for months now. Free weights, compound movement, squat, deadlift, bench press, rows, etc. And I'm finally starting to get close to an intermediate level of strength. That said, I've been looking at a lot of body weight training lately and have played around with it a few times. It really feels good to me and leaves my body feeling ready, energized, and functionally strong in a way that free weight training rarely does. What I'm wondering is, how strong can one get doing purely body weight / leverage training, assuming you work out around 3 hours per week like is typical with strong lifts? How does body weight training compare with free weights in terms of reaching your genetic potential for body composition? If you had to choose purely one method of training over the other, which would you pick? Thanks so much. Keep on keeping on."
Gosh. Next question. No, I hate boiling this stuff down to kind of an either or thing. You know, like I like elements of the power lifts. I absolutely love elements of the Olympic lifts. I've been doing a lot of ring strength type stuff and then, lever progressions, bent arm and straight arm progressions that I got from Ido Portal. And I dig all of it in my training. Definitely, it's probably 3 to 4 hours a week right now. Like I get four, maybe five sessions a week, and each session is half hour to 45 minutes. So I'm right in that wheelhouse. But I do some weights and I do some upper body stuff. But, you know, it's I do weighted chins and weighted dips, so I don't know if that counts as purely body weight stuff or, you know, I don't know. It's body weight plus. I am a plus size, so I don't know. Like, I think it's kind of funny. Like, I remember Matt Fury came out with, like, the combat conditioning book, and everybody was in a fizz that, you know, lifting weights. It was almost as gauche as doing curls and tricep extensions and stuff like that has been in the functional training realm, you know, where you were like a pervert at church, you know, doing this stuff. And then the reality is like, it's all pretty good and it's all particularly good if you like it. So I guess I would boil this thing down to do the stuff you like and probably vary it a little bit. Like, trying to get too optimized on this stuff, unless you have something really, really specific, you're competing in a sport or something like that. Beyond that, just try to lift some weights and be jacked and don't suck. And I think that's pretty good. I don't know, Greg, do you have anything better than that? Or
Yeah. My question to Ken is, why do you have to choose one or the other? I mean, it's clear that you have access to barbell and barbell-related gear because you're using it right now. And you obviously have access to your own body. So, you know, I just don't see a reason to choose one or the other. And, you know, to specifically answer your question, no, I don't believe you can get as strong as possible with body weight only stuff. Can you get really strong? Yeah, you can get super strong. But I think the progression is extremely long term. And you're talking about gymnasts who have come up since the age of, you know, 5 to 8 years old. And have been training for 10 years. And with regard to leg strength specifically, I think that definitely falls a bit short at times.
Yeah. You know, if there was a demarcation, I would say, and, you know, Ito talks about this a fair amount also, where you just can't get the leg development that you can get out of Olympic lifts and Olympic lifting derivatives. And people can get all spun up about West Side Barbell and you know, bands and chains and box jumps and all that sort of stuff. But I've tinkered with all of it. I've competed in powerlifting. I've dabbled in O-lifting. And I think for athletics, I'd like to see O-lifting plus some additional posterior chain development, you know, which isn't all that hard to do. That's not rocket science to pull that stuff off. Maybe Greg can comment on that also. But, you know, I guess for time efficiency, you're going to get bigger, stronger, faster just using weights in general. But then if you stick with kind of the big body weight, you know, kind of progressions like rope climbs, dips, pull-ups, variations off of that stuff, you can still do it in a very time efficient manner and get damn strong off of it. So
yeah, I mean, if you're running a very basic barbell strength program, throw in some bodyweight exercise finishers each day and you're good to go. Vary that stuff up a bunch, stay consistent with the barbell stuff. And I mean, I just don't see how you can go wrong with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, it's great for mobility. Particularly I'll say some of the upper body stuff like the ring strength work, front levers, back levers, skin the cats, jackknife pushups, all that sort of stuff are really legit for mobility characteristics of the upper body, and they'll get you pretty damn strong too. So, yeah.
Indeed. So, yeah, unless you get sent to prison and it's one of the prisons where they've removed all the weights and you have no other choice, don't limit yourself. I just don't see a reason.
Right you are, Ken.
And, you know, even in prison, you can fill a plastic bag with water and you can still do upright rows and curls with it.
Totally,
so,
dude. You can totally get your pump on.
Yeah. You just don't put a ceiling over yourself.
Cool.
All right. Speaking of barbell lifting, this next question is regarding powerlifting. The most completely misnamed sport in the history of sports.
Other than maybe the sport of fitness, possibly.
Well, I don't want to comment on that. Well, I do, but I'm not going to. Toby says, Rob, been listening for about 6 months, although all the food talk and the Chipotle visible from my office window seems to stimulate my appetite. Sometimes I have to stop the podcast to get a carnitas bowl with avocado.
It's funny. Usually when we talk, it stimulates more lower bowel function and people need to void themselves. But that's cool. That's good to know.
Yeah, it's good to know we have more than one response.
Totally.
Saw your powerlifting numbers. Very impressive. A few questions. I'm assuming your numbers are equipped. What are your raw PRs? Were you paleo prior to competition? Don't start laughing yet. We got to finish. I've been powerlifting for the last year and have seen some great gains due to the dedicated training, but I'm still working out the diet/ideal weight details. I'm 6 foot and range between 245 and 265 pounds, currently 260 with 23% body fat. In 2008, I was 260 with 35% body fat and compared to now, weak. I got your book last fall and followed paleo pretty strictly, especially no dairy, grains, or legumes. That's pretty much sums it up.
That's pretty much it.
In about 3 months, I dropped to 245, the lowest I'd been in a few years, but was very weak. I was missing lifts I'd hit when I was heavier. Frustrated, I started pounding the dairy and upping my fat intake. In 3 months with dedicated training, I'd increased deadlift from a hard 425 single to an easy 465 double, bench from under 315 to tripling 315. Unfortunately, in 3 months, I'd packed on the pounds as well. Weight exceeded 260. My new jeans were getting tight. Stop buying emo skinny jeans, dude. The biggest benefit for me from paleo is the anti-inflammatory effects of omega-3 and the removal of grains. If I slip and have a few beers or bread, I feel like an old man. I'd like to compete at 242, would like to keep the strength at the lower weight and don't feel I can train slash recover without dairy. What diet slash training advice can you suggest? That was a dense one.
Yeah, there were like 50 questions in there. So just to defend my honor a little bit there at the very beginning, I in fact lifted that stuff wearing a belt, and I had some knee wraps.
But you had nothing but a belt on?
I did have a singlet also.
That's super raw federation.
It's the Castro District Federation, yeah. So it was very, very popular. It was for NASA, Natural Athlete Strength Association, which is a non-geared federation in all senses of the term. Basically, you get a belt. At that time, the knee wraps were allowed, and this is in the early days of knee wraps, so it was basically an ace bandage. It wasn't like a triple ply suit or bench shirt or any of that stuff.
So basically, all it did was irritate your skin.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So those were actually legit. Not quite. To me, raw is no belt, no wraps at all. So a belt at that point for me would add 5 to 8% to my top end, and even those basically ace bandage type knee wraps would add about 5% to me. And this is one of the interesting things about the various geared powerlifting federations where you know that a bench shirt is going to add 10 to 20%. You know that your squat briefs are going to add X percent and everything. And I get the argument that, you know, you learn how to use that stuff and that's just the federation you're lifting in. But it's still my right to say that that's damn goofy. And so we'll just move on from that. And then from there, you know, I mean, there's a reality that if you want to be really strong, being bigger is really, really facilitates that process. Particularly, I think on the squat, probably more than anything else. I know whenever I lean out even a little bit, that I notice it immediately, just kind of almost like a you know, thoracic or spinal, you know, instability that seems to set in relative to being a little bit chunky through the midsection.
You got to have that torso girth.
Yeah, yeah. And, the West Side guys actually talk about this a ton. You can find it in the Olympic lifting literature and everything. Intramuscular fat deposition improves intramuscular levers a little bit and stuff like that. So there's a bunch of things where the leverage values improve with this stuff. But then you kind of have to ask yourself a question, you know, is that where you want to steer the boat for, like, health and wellness and longevity and all that sort of jive? And so you can take kind of a slower long-term approach to this, trying to be around that 242 level, constantly tinkering with body composition, trying to get more muscle mass at that 242 level, you know, decrease body fat level, increase muscle mass level, which is just a matter of time and tinkering, or you're going to be bigger and have more impressive, more kind of ego-gratifying lifts. But it's really, really hard to have both unless you go the other gear route and have a ton of anabolics in your system. And even then, I'll make the argument that if you eat better and throw some anabolics on top of that, you're probably going to get superior value out of the whole process. But I don't know the simple answer to that. You know, like if you drop your caloric intake, say like you're not doing a gallon of milk a day, I'm not shocked at all that you don't feel as strong and that your recovery isn't quite as good, because you're just not going to be as big. You can almost ride that linear progression pony infinitely if you keep your caloric intake high enough.
Yeah, you've got to eat your way through those plateaus.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no such thing as overtraining, just undereating.
Undereating. That was John Perillo out of like the 80s, you know. So I don't know what much more to say than that. And Greg, you've played a ton with bringing your body weight up and down. What's your thought on all that stuff?
Yeah, I think definitely if you're not eating at least some slight excess of calories, you're just not going to feel as strong. And now, granted, in theory, if you're eating constantly eating more than you need, you're going to continue gaining weight. But you know, this can be controlled pretty well. It's not like you're going to continue gaining weight forever. And so if you want to compete at 110 kilos, 242, like Rob said, you just need to work on getting your body composition a little more solid. And, you know, what I would try doing, because in my experience, a lot of people, and myself included, have a lot of trouble gaining body weight and maintaining body weight without a pretty significant amount of carbohydrate, irrespective of the training that's being done. So what I would suggest, though, in terms of body composition, is that you limit your carb intake to primarily vegetables, except when you're in that kind of post-training window, and then get as much in there as you can, and then kind of do a cyclic low-carb approach. You know, every couple days, have what Rob would call the carb freak out. Get as much in there as you can, and that should help kind of keep that body composition improving or in range without you losing a ton of weight and strength. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, and maybe even the cyclic approach being every day, you know, essentially every training day. The problem that we've had, like, I kind of suffered from this. I know with Greg, he suffered from this. At some point, you just can't eat any more fat and protein. Like, literally, your digestive tract gives you the bird, and it's like, I'm not doing that. I'm not going there anymore. And so you get a steatorrhea. You get some poop that is well fat imbued, and it blasts right out of you. And this is where you need some other cofactors in there just for the calories, if nothing else. And, you know, we were tinkering with this stuff with Wellborn, and who has been 330 before, 315, 330 before. So we're not taking him anywhere that he hasn't gone. But it's interesting, you know, we were real low carb with him and, you know, high protein, high fat. He was doing good. He went from like 280 to 290, and then he just started kind of slowing down, and we started doing really aggressive post-workout yam or sweet potato feedings, and the dude's up to 320, and his body fat is at 11% now. And when we started, he was at 280 and about 18%.
So what kind of volume of sweet potatoes are we talking?
For John, because he's big, he's doing a probably 200, 300 grams of carbs post-workout. Gotcha. A little pinner dude like me would be more, 100, 150 grams of carbs. And they don't have to be all entirely post-workout, but, you know, to the degree you can, doing the post-workout window. So if you train in the evening, then your last two meals of the day are you know, like protein and carbs, and then your earlier meals in the day are more protein and fat. But I think doing a little bit more carbs post-workout, and then also tackling this as if it were a training block, and I think Greg alluded to this a little bit earlier, tackle this for 3 months. Like, give yourself a dedicated period of time in which you're going to mass gain, and then you're going to tinker with the macros again and try to optimize body composition at that new weight. And that's where you can do kind of a high-ish volume, moderate to high intensity training block, and which will help you lean out, but should help you maintain muscle mass and maintain your strength. It's not going to be perfect, but you have to kind of stair-step this thing up a little bit.
Yeah, the stair-stepping thing is a good point, because I think people make the mistake a lot of times of just throwing in constant change. And so their body weight is fluctuating all over the place. They have no idea. They really have no idea what their current body weight set point is, because they've never given themselves a chance to sit there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I get my weight up to a certain amount and I can keep it there for 2-3 weeks, I'm going to be pretty good. If I hit that and then I back off at all, then I'm going to start over again. You know what I mean? And I think that's pretty consistently true for everybody. If you can maintain a given weight, whether you're losing or gaining, for a couple weeks, then you have a lot more latitude to start tinkering with the details without having this sudden loss of weight or a sudden gain of weight.
Totally.
All right. Well, enough about fat powerlifters. Let's talk about fat weightlifters instead.
Perfect.
Oh, wait, no. Let's talk about some Brazilian jiu-jitsu first.
Sweet.
We'll talk about the skinny guys for a while.
Nice. We're in my wheelhouse now.
Yeah. So Doug says, been paleo since December, and it's been a life-changing experience for me. Your podcasts are an amazing resource. I wanted to ask you to comment on Brazilian jiu-jitsu and how it relates to paleo fitness, and to get your general advice on how to integrate some of your exercise philosophy into conditioning for grappling. Thanks.
You know, I would ask a couple of questions up front here, which would, you know, one of them, what's your technical level in jits? Like, are you still really in a skill acquisition period? or are you at a black belt level and you're already, you know, obviously you always learn, you always grow, but are you still kind of a beginner, like blue belt, purple belt, or are you more like purple, brown, black, you know, kind of gig? If you are very technically proficient and very efficient at your game, then part of this thing may necessitate more non-sport related conditioning. Like we might do something more like circuits and stuff like that. If you're still more in a skill acquisition phase of your development, then I would recommend virtually nothing that looks like CrossFit or circuit training or stuff like that. We did a really, really good piece for the performance menu, Fight Prep, or we just called that one Fight, right? Or was it Fight Prep?
I think it was Fight Prep.
Just Fight Prep. And, you know, with that, we tracked the process that we did with Glenn, which basically we O-lifted Glenn with the power variance. And here again, I put in some extra posterior chain work, like some glute ham raises, some Romanian deadlifts and stuff. It was more posterior chain supplemental work than what you would see in like a classic O-lifting scene. But, you know, we power snatch, power cleaned, split cleaned. We did some push jerks and split jerks mixed into all that stuff. And we did a lot of gymnastics strength progressions, front levers, back levers, press to handstands, various ring work type stuff. But in all of this, the rep scheme was pretty low. Tried to really de-emphasize the eccentric loading, the lowering portion of different movements like squatting and deadlifting. Deadlifting, we just had Glenn drop the bar from the top and stuff like that to really take the eccentric load out of different things so that it would impact his recovery as minimally as possible. The interesting thing is when we first started working with Glenn, he was at about 162 pounds, fought at 155. We ended up taking him up to 174 pounds, changed his eating to cyclic low carb paleo. Cyclic being a little bit of a misnomer because it was basically like anytime he trained, we post workout, we ended up being very, very aggressive in his carb repletion. But his other meals, say like earlier in the day, were typically just like protein and fat meals. But we took Glenn from 162 at about 12% body fat to about 174 and about 7 or 8% body fat. Ended up getting the guy 275-pound clean and jerk, 235-pound snatch. And again, these are power clean and power snatch. Amazing numbers on the or skills in the gymnastics realm. And then all that we did for conditioning was fight training. So pad work, bag work, clinch work, grappling, you know, positional grappling and all that sort of stuff. But what was interesting was that we would use a fight gone bad workout, just classic fight gone bad, a five-station CrossFit workout. And we used that once every 7 to 10 days as a diagnostic measure. And Glenn ended up turning a 437 on fight gone bad. And the only conditioning that he did was fight training again. But he had amazing technical proficiency in the Olympic lifts and in the gymnastic skills. And then he built engine from his sport. And so in general, that's what I would recommend is a low volume, high intensity, intensity being just a relative percent of rep maximum loading on different strength movements, squatting, deadlifting, you know, weighted chins, all that sort of jive. And then doing as much skill specific work as you can. I mean, even down to the point of like, I think it's kind of goofy to do a bunch of crazy warm-up stuff in martial arts. Like I would rather, in a jiu-jitsu scene, I'd rather see people doing like Greco hand fighting drills and stuff like that. And this is right out of the Straight Blast Gym kind of playbook, you know, use sport-specific drills to warm up and cool down and all the rest of that. And it's not being goofy where like when I say sport-specific, you know, you have a weighted club that you're swinging because you are a golf player. I'm not talking about that. I'm actually like doing more of your sport is what I'd recommend. So I'm not too sure if that was all over the place. Greg, you trained, I'm blanking on your guy that did some Muay Thai and all. Leo. What was your approach? Was it similar to that or?
Very similar. Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got your strength training kind of foundation there. And then the biggest conditioning deal is going to be actually fighting or sparring or skill work. And so something I did too that I actually liked and would do again was we would throw together real quick circuits, maybe like 2 to 3 minutes, kind of get them a little bit worn out. Then we'd throw them into, say, a 2 to 3 minute round of sparring work on mm-hmm. the thigh pads or whatnot. So the conditioning is really coming from the sport work. but he's coming into it fatigued.
Right. We did that with Glenn also, where we'd have him do a 500-meter sprint or like a one-minute really hard sprint, and then we would have four additional minutes of positional sparring or Thai boxing and clinch, and we'd rotate in a fresh guy each minute. But we would do the same thing where we would put Glenn in at a deficit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is the best way to do it, because there's nothing that's going to condition you for fighting other than fighting. And, right. And when I say fighting, I'm trying to cover everything. So it's totally specific to what you're doing. Grappling's a hell of a lot different than, you know, striking stuff, and you've got to do it. Like, I don't care how much you can row or run or do Fran or whatever. It doesn't translate as well to actually fighting than fighting.
And the only caveat that I would have with that is, again, when you are at the epitome level of efficiency with your sport, Greg and I actually both went up and did a session with Matt Thornton. It was like a 3-day deal, and Matt weighs like 275 pounds and is a BJJ black belt and has an A-level boxing game and everything. But basically my sternum was like 2 inches flatter by the end of the weekend from getting mashed around. But Matt was commenting that he's so efficient with rolling that he can just roll and roll and roll, and he gets out of shape from that. But he's been a black belt for like 8 years. At that point, he had been a black belt for like 8 or 9 years. So he had already been a black belt for like 8 or 9 years. And so he was at a point of efficiency where it's just so woven into his brain to be efficient that he needs to do conditioning outside of the sport to help augment what he's doing in the sport. But it's rare, even with boxers and stuff like that. You know, like Fred Hatfield did something similar to this with Evander Holyfield, who, again, you know, is essentially at that master level of the sport, you know, super, super efficient, still doing plenty of bag work and sparring work and everything, but really benefited from some specific non-eccentric loading type conditioning. He did a bunch of sprints and plyos and basically time indexed it specific to his sport, which was 3-minute rounds. But that's where it's important to kind of know who you're working with, and, you know, are they at the earlier stages of the skill development? Do they still benefit more from simply being fatigued and being thrown into a sport-specific scenario for their training, or they at such a high level of technicality that they really do legitimately benefit from some other conditioning? But those people are rare, really, really rare.
Yeah. Yep. I concur. I think my ribs are still hurting from Matt.
That was awesome.
It was so awesome that I don't ever need to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Oddly enough, we didn't go back, but Matt's a great dude. So yeah.
Yeah.
So hopefully that helps with the, jits and pugilistic arts and fitness. It's kind of funny because you see so many of these things on like the UFC Unleashed or whatever that show is, and it'll show these guys doing all these crazy circuit training workouts. And most guys that are really at a high level are not doing much of that work at all. The only time that we really did anything that looked CrossFit-esque with Glenn was when he was either injured and we were trying to maintain his anaerobic capacity, or if he was just burned out on being in the gym and like actually getting in and doing some CrossFit type classes was fun because he still could compete and he could keep that anaerobic capacity kind of going. But in anything remotely like a fight prep, you don't have the recovery for it. You just flat don't.
Yeah. All right. Moving right along.
Enough of that.
Now we get
silliness.
To talk about fat weightlifters.
There we go.
Jeff, the paleo playboy, says, for Mr. Everett, accommodating resistance in the Olympic lifts, thoughts? I have lots of thoughts on that, but so I'll try to keep it fairly brief.
So tell people what accommodating resistance is.
So basically it's the use of bands and chains. The idea is that the strength curve in any movement is not constant. So for example, at the bottom of the squat, your leverage is poor, so it's much more difficult to move the weight than it is at the top where your leverage is better. So, for example, if you throw some chains on a bar, throw some bands around the bar, there's going to be greater resistance at the top where you're stronger than there is at the bottom where you're weaker. Idea being you can train that whole range kind of more equally throughout the movement.
And it's encouraging you to try to accelerate through that whole movement.
Yeah, in theory.
Yeah.
My big deal with it is I don't really have any objection to it for power lifters or for anybody else, really, although for a non-power lifter, especially a non-geared power lifter, I just don't see a need for it. It looks cool. You know, it sounds awesome to say accommodating resistance, but I just don't really see a need. For weightlifting specifically, I think it's absolutely counterproductive and it has no place in the sport and training for the sport. With the Olympic lifts, we'll talk about a pole, for example. When you get near the top of the pole, you know, above the knee, mid thigh, yeah, you're in a much stronger position, which is what allows you to impart that final explosiveness, that acceleration to the bar to get it high enough and to get enough inertia on it for you to get under it. You start throwing bands and chains into that equation, and all of a sudden, even though you're trying to accelerate it maximally at the top, the bar is either slowing down or moving the same speed. So not only are you not able to lift it properly, you're actually ingraining this feeling into your body of not moving fast. And so some people will argue, well, you know, the attempt to accelerate against that resistance is the same thing as actually going fast. And I think that's utter nonsense. And you have to keep in mind, too, that at the top of a pole, you know, a snatch or a clean, or even at the top of the drive of a jerk, the thing that happens next is you change directions and move your body under the bar. You know, that can't happen properly if you have something tugging the bar back, especially a band. A chain is not as dramatic, but a band just gets super crazy. You know, it's not like doing deadlifts where you get to the top and then you just bring the weight back down, or even squats for that matter. It's entirely different. And so I think if you're really curious, try throwing some bands and chains into your weightlifting training, and I think you'll quit that very quickly.
And, you know, I would throw something in here, having come out of a way more powerlifting derivative background. Fred Hatfield, bodybuilding a scientific approach, power a scientific approach, powerlifting a scientific approach. Fred Hatfield, Dr. Squat, one of the first dudes to squat over 1,000 pounds, body weight 242. I think he was in his mid-40s when he did it. Really, really bright guy. And he just talked about this concept within powerlifting of essentially what he called it was a compensatory acceleration. Like, everybody likes a snazzy word. But, you know, for the powerlifter or even most athletes, it's just thinking about moving the weight fast and really trying to impart velocity on it, whether you're squatting, deadlifting, power cleaning, whatever. And then it doesn't change the legitimate characteristics of the movement all that much relative to, like, putting bands and chains on there and stuff. So,
right. Yeah, and it's like, you know, when my lifters in here squat, the descent is controlled with the exception of front squats. Sometimes we go a little fast on the way down too. But the ascent is always an attempt to accelerate as much as possible all the way to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good enough. You start throwing bands on there and it's just unnecessary.
You know, it's funny. I will throw myself under the bus with this, which was when I was new to the Olympic lifts via, you know, CrossFit exposure, I could do them relatively better than most of the people that I was around. And so I assumed I knew something about them. And I made all kinds of preposterous, you know, statements like you didn't need to wear O-lifting shoes to be successful and stuff like that. And then I got exposed to people who actually knew what they were doing. And I cowered with my tail, you know, between my legs and was rightly chagrined at my idiocy. And so it's just, you know, it's always great to cross-pollinate. It's always great to compare notes. Everybody's always got a good shtick on something. But I think that it really behooves people to do a little bit of a hat tip towards people who've been doing the shit that they're doing for a long time and doing it at an Olympic caliber status, whether they're gymnasts or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think going in with a little bit more respect, I'd have to say I had the same sort of hubris towards people who trained endurance athletes. You know, I thought that sprint modalities and circuit training were going to be the end-all be-all for ultra marathons or marathoning. It's just not. It can be a nice little adjunctive piece, but it's not. And then the way that Olympic lifters train, there seems to be a certain uniformity across the world with it. The only variable here seems to be whether or not you come from a country that drug tests aggressively or aggressively puts drugs within your reach, you know, and that seems to be the delineation between the two. So,
yeah, I mean, and there's a decent amount of variation in programming from program to program and country to country with weightlifters, but never have I seen a band or a chain hanging in a weightlifting gym other than my own. And mainly they just, the bands are for warming up and the chains are there because they look cool. No one ever uses them. I think people use them to throw around their necks during dips sometime because it looks cooler than having a weight around your waist.
It goes well with the pit bull and the shaved head and the goatee. So
yeah, it's, you know, point being, if they offered something phenomenal for weightlifting or something at all, they would be getting put to use. And it's really that simple. There's no weightlifting coach or weightlifter out there in the world who doesn't want to use every possible thing he can to get better. So speaking of shoes, let's talk about this next one, which has
a new
word for me. So I'm going to try not to mess it up. Graham says, I know you are not an orthopedist. That's not the new word, by the way. But how important are the right shoes beyond having arch support? My myokinesthesial therapist, that's the new word,
nice,
calls weightlifting shoes, five fingers, and dress shoes nothing but gimmicks in light of what's comfortable or form fit. What shoes do you use? Love the podcast.
What shoes do you use, Greg?
I use weightlifting shoes because I weightlift. And I think what really kind of irks me about this is categorizing weightlifting shoes, toe shoes, and dress shoes
all in the same category.
Yeah, it's doesn't even make sense. I'll give you this. Five fingers, do not want. I don't like those things. They look creepy. They remind me of the Henry Rollins quote from many years ago, and he says, every time I see someone in soft shoes, I want to step on their toes. So it's like, I don't get it. I think they certainly have a place. So I don't mean to bag on everyone who wears toe shoes, unless you're wearing those toe socks also. Then it's just, I mean, that's just
darn
weird.
Silly.
But regarding dress shoes, dude, you wear dress shoes to look good. You're not going to wear toe shoes with a suit. And, you know, you're not going to wear your DC skate shoes with a suit. So dress shoes are for dressing up and looking hot. So I don't even know where those – I mean, I guess you could go out and get some hush puppies and you could, you know, get some Velcro shoes or whatever is going on. But with regard to weightlifting shoes specifically, we get this a lot, honestly, with some of our fitness clients. Well, I don't want to wear weightlifting shoes. Oh, that's cheating and this and that, and it's not natural. It's like, well, the barbell you're holding right now is not natural either. So if you really want to run the natural argument, you need to go swing around some trees and pick up some rocks. Otherwise, save it. And then the best part, though, is that – and this happened again very recently with one of our clients, completely resistant to weightlifting shoes, didn't want to hear it. Finally, Steve actually talked him into wearing weightlifting shoes one night, did a set of squats, looked at Steve, and just didn't even have to say anything. It was like, okay, I get it. I'm not going to say another word. And now he wears weightlifting shoes when he does the lifts.
Right.
And I mean, so weightlifting shoes are, they exist for a reason. It's not an accident. You know, you have a raised heel because that increases the range of motion of the ankle, and the ankle has to flex, dorsiflex a great deal to hit those bottom positions with an upright torso. It's just unavoidable unless your femur is only 4 inches long. So in one regard, it's a safety issue. If you bottom out that ankle, you're going to be in big trouble. It's not going to feel good. It's going to take a long time to recover from. It's going to be a huge limiting factor forever, essentially. And you also have an extremely rigid, stable platform to stand on. And so the response to that is usually like, oh, well, I wear Chuck Taylors or I wear old school Vans. That's a flat sole. Yeah, it's flat, but it's still squishy. I promise you, no matter how hard you think it is, it's a lot squishier than a weightlifting shoe. So like the whole paleo deal that Rob always spits out, try it.
Yeah, just play
okay?
with it.
Stop freaking pontificating about it all over the internet. Wear them. If you like them, if they work for you, continue to wear them. If you don't, then, you know, wear dress shoes or toe shoes or whatever you want. I don't care if you wear Jerusalem cruisers. You know what I mean? Do what works for you and enjoy it.
You know, if folks are tackling kind of a general fitness deal and you're doing sumo lifting and some trail running and maybe some plyo work and stuff like that, then maybe you should have a pair of O-lifting shoes, a pair of Vibrams, and then a pair of like Asics Tigers that you can do some stop-start mobility work with. Because, you know, I definitely don't lift as well unless I have O-lifting shoes on. If I'm doing some sort of off-road stomping around, the Vibrams are kind of cool to wear. But the thing is that if I do any type of legitimate acceleration or change of direction drills, I will destroy my pair of Vibrams in one session. And I've done it. I have blown the sidewall out of a brand new pair in one session of just change of direction drills. Whereas my Asics Tigers end up lasting for 2 years. So I, you know, it's, again, like really cool to experiment with stuff. We live in an amazing time where we have all kinds of different options and everything. But sometimes looking at who is doing things really, really well and then kind of emulating that, even if you're kind of a generalist, is maybe not a bad idea. And again, like I really goofed this one up early on thinking that you could O-lift just fine without, you know, the raised heel and all the rest of that. You absolutely cannot.
Well, yeah. And some people get by without them for quite a while, and they do fairly impressive lifts. But, I mean, literally the moment they put those shoes on, you can see it in their reaction. They understand why
it's so,
you know,
important.
Dickheads like me are always getting on their back about it. So,
yeah.
But like Rob said, if you're doing a bunch of different types of training, you're not just weightlifting, then maybe you need a couple different pairs of shoes. And if you're doing some kind of circuit that has some kind of weightlifting movement, some kind of non-weightlifting movement, then find some kind of in-between shoe like he's talking about, you know. So a fairly flexible, flat-soled shoe that doesn't allow you to roll your ankle so easily.
Yeah.
And it gives you kind of some good connection to the ground. All right. So let's this is going to be another good one. I like this one.
It's a beefy one.
I'm eating paleo and doing Metcons with kettlebells and bodyweight exercises. I'm trying to build strength and size and cut fat. It's working very well. Remember that sentence. A guy I know said I should check out Slow Burn. This is the Fred Hahn or Frank Hahn or
right.
Gary Hahn or someone Hahn. Basically, low reps to total muscle failure. How would that methodology fit in? What results do you get when you do that?
So,
Robert,
Greg,
care to comment?
You wanted to point something out. Which was the thing you wanted to point
out? Yeah, this is the key sentence in this whole thing. It's working very well. So immediately my question is, if it's working very well, why are you messing with it?
Exactly.
And I get that people are curious, and this is one of the problems with the internet is there's so much freaking information that people can't just focus on what they're doing, even if it's working very well. So go ahead, Rob.
So from there, you know, I as a big picture thing, like the slow burn kind of concept at Body by Science, I like this stuff as like a quick, time-efficient way to maintain some muscle mass, maintain some strength, maintain some power. Like, I like all those guys. All those dudes are super cool. Fred Hahn's super cool. Body by Science is super cool. But one thing that Louis Simmons has said, everything works, nothing works forever. And so for me, I just like, personally, a little bit more of what I would call athletic-type strength training. So like moving barbells quickly, using some kettlebells, throwing some medicine balls, doing some gymnastics type stuff. But that's the type of stuff I like to do. Is that wholly, completely appropriate for like my 300-pound orthopedically challenged client? Absolutely not. Or when I was talking to Dr. Mike Eads about this stuff, I was like, hey, doc, you know, in Protein Power Life Plan, you had a very kind of fast twitch-oriented, explosive strength and conditioning kind of recommendation for your book, which I liked. Then you shifted gears, kind of got into the slow burn kind of thing. You know, why the change in methodology? And he was like, I don't like working out. And I'll go in and do a 20-minute slow burn session per week. And it keeps my golf game good. It keeps my muscle mass solid. And that's all I need. And he's like, and the best program that anybody can do is the program that they continue to do. And I was like, Roger that. That's totally cool. So I just, you know, I don't think there's any like ultimate, you know, perfect solutions to anything. When you look at Olympic lifting, they do both rate of force development and hypertrophy work, and they do max effort work. You know, it's essentially the conjugate method, but not called the conjugate method because it just makes sense to do all that stuff depending on what you have going on. And I think within this context, like the slow hit-esque one rep to failure type stuff is very, very effective for certain things. And then it's not going to be as effective for other stuff. And I'll burn in high intensity training hell for saying that, but that's my thought on it. And like Greg said at the beginning, if what you're doing is working, ride that pony until it dies, until you're scratching your head wondering why it's not working anymore, and then start figuring out your next step.
Yeah. And, you know, the second sentence in there is, I'm trying to build strength and size and cut fat. And so, you know, when you talk about strength and size, barbell is the first thing that comes to mind. You know, not Metcon, certainly. Kettlebells, yeah, they have a place. Bodyweight exercises, yeah, they have a place. But, you know, make a decision on what you really want to do and place some kind of emphasis on at least one thing. You need to have at least a primary goal. Even if you have multiple goals, you need to prioritize to some degree.
Yeah, because
you really cannot do everything at once.
Because he did sneak that in here where it's like, I'm trying to do everything at once and it's going great. So what I would, you know, reading into that, I'd say, okay, we have a complete beginner here. And well, then and soon it's going to be tough.
Yeah. With regard to slow burn specifically, I think, yeah, it may work for some people for some period of time. But I think the way in which it's going to work is going to be specific to body composition. If it works, what it's going to do for you is maybe build some muscle, maybe help you lean out a little bit. But like Rob said, it's going to contribute absolutely nothing towards any kind of athleticism. And so if you just hate working out and you want to get in the gym and get it done with, then it's something to experiment with. If you like working out, if you like being athletic, I can't imagine putting myself through that misery, even if it's only for 20 minutes a day.
And you know what? A good person to check out who I think straddles this world really well is Keith over at Theory to Practice, because he does some slow burn, hit-esque type stuff on some pretty jazzy contraptions, but then he also does some O-lift and O-lift derivatives, some single gear bike sprints, and the dude is big, strong, and jacked. And I like what he's doing in that he's got a nice variety in what he's up to. He pulls in some conjugate method. He pulls in some Olympic lifting. He plays around with kettlebells. He makes good use of the slow burn hit-esque concepts, and he plays with volume and intensity, and he just doesn't let any one methodology make him its bitch. You know,
that's a key point right there.
You know, he makes it all work for him, and he does it in an amazing way. And Keith's a really bright guy, and he's very non-dogmatic about this stuff, really loves the N equal one approach to everything. So Theory to Practice, man, I would give that a look. If you're really, really trying to hunt up a nice generalist fitness approach, and it's got some slow burn-esque stuff in it, but regardless of that, just a good generalist fitness approach, check out Theory to Practice. Keith is the man.
All right. Any more thoughts on that, Mr. Wolf?
Nine.
Okay. Nine more thoughts?
Nine more thoughts. Isn't that the way it works? Don't they ask like 20 questions? I just have a question. Oh, and then subcategory A, B, C,
yes.
D.
I just have 16 questions. Okay. Primal Druid says, hey, Rob, now with 80% more Greg. Although, I mean, I was an English major, not a math major, but I believe it's 100% more Greg.
I don't know. Maybe you've always been here at some sort of space-time continuum something. Yeah, I don't know.
All right. I'll give you that. You guys must know something I don't. I'm a 33-year-old man who just got into the paleo way of life and wishes he'd found it a lot sooner. I began this journey at a whopping 340 pounds in the worst shape of my life, and I'm now sitting at 294. Still overweight, but after about 3 months of paleo living, that's not a bad loss, I think. I agree, Paleo Druid.
Absolutely.
There was a time in my life when I was in very good shape. I played soccer, engaged in martial arts, and swam competitively. I'd love to start getting more back into those sorts of things, as well as starting a CrossFit program more well-rounded than doing the bear complex once a week at my gym. But I know that I'm in no shape yet to pull that off. What do you suggest as a good benchmark for fitness for people like me who were or still are dangerously overweight? What would you say is a good model for what we should be able to do in order to consider moving past eat right and work out a little bit and more into destroy myself in the gym a few times a week and not make a fool of myself? I'd like to one day get myself to the point where I can move my body around without my weight being too much of a detriment, maybe even a bit of gymnastics, but right now I'm still stuck in a shape that resists putting my ass above my head. What do you guys think?
I feel like this is almost
four sentences, Rob.
Yeah. Almost a cop out, but you know, I mean, you just have to take it slow and steady. And I don't know what else to say beyond that. Greg might have some better insight on this. I have a really, really good beginning template in my book, and it sounds like you're probably a little bit beyond that. But in the beginning, it's, you know, do a 200-meter walk and then 10 sit-to-stands and 10 push-ups against either a wall or against a counter that's at you know, chest or belly button height. And then you do a couple of cycles of that. And then the next time you come back, you try to go a little, you do the whole thing a little bit faster. And amidst all that, you sleep 9 or 10 hours a night and eat, you know, lowish carb paleo and take some fish oil and take some vitamin D. And you'll lose weight very, very quickly, very efficiently. And as your fitness starts getting better, then the push-ups move from the counter to down on the ground. And instead of a walk, you're doing a jog. And at some point, you get leaned down to a degree where you're kind of like, okay, I think I'm ready to start working some, you know, maybe some push-up variations, maybe even trying to kick up to a handstand against a wall. And if you don't have that skill set, then you find a coach to help you with it. And you kind of go from there. But you're doing great. It's just I think you're maybe getting a little bit cart before the horse. We just need to put in some more just sweat equity on this and get you leaned out so that you've got less weight that you're lugging around and you can do more. I mean, the exercise is important, but honestly, the diet and lifestyle is more important. Like it's great for you to be active every single day, but being nutritionally compliant and sleeping well are more beneficial for the weight loss really practically than the exercise is. We want to do some exercise to rev up your metabolism, maintain your muscle mass, but then beyond that, it's all chow and sleep.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to point out 45 pounds of weight lost in 3 months. I mean, that's an awesome job.
That's phenomenal. Yeah.
So you're already obviously on the right track, and so you know, stick to that and keep that in mind. And like Rob said, you know, just take it in stages. And yeah, I get that it probably gets boring and you're in a hurry to kind of get back to your fighting weight, but you know, do the long, slow kind of quote unquote cardio work sometimes. Do modifications of the things you see. You know, take it easy on the ballistic stuff. You know, jumping, bounding. You know, at 294, not a great deal for the joints, but you can mimic a lot of that stuff with zero impact just to get different styles of movements in there to keep you a little more interested, mm-hmm. and at least make you feel like you're moving toward that, that end goal. So, and yeah, obviously the nutrition is the vast majority of it. You're going to get way more mileage out of that than from the exercise, especially at this point.
Yeah. But you know, let us know what you do and keep us posted. Like you're crushing it. You're doing great. So keep us posted on it.
And hopefully by next show, I'll have the other 20% of me here.
I saw that on a forwarding envelope somewhere.
Yeah. No promises, though. All right.
Sweet.
Well, I think we pretty much covered everything we could possibly cover related to training in the universe.
I like it.
Pretty good range. Oh, so, and real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Shauna, I got your email. And yes, you did a great job with your English, but if you really want to know, I found about a dozen errors. So if you're curious, I'd be happy to email them over to you. I won't call you out here on the podcast, but thank
this,
you.
This was the torture of my life. Well, it was Greg's torture too. I'm a horrible writer and he had to edit everything I wrote and I hate being edited. And Greg is, just a step down from like a computer in his ability to pick up grammatical and punctuation errors and stuff like that. So that was a ton of fun.
You're not a bad writer. You're just super artistic. You're on a plane so far beyond the rules of grammar and punctuation that it just doesn't even occur to you.
I just find my own way, man. It's just how I gotta be.
Yeah, the last thing I want to do is prevent you from just being yourself.
Sweet.
But we do have to make it actually readable for people.
Right.
They have to know at least somewhat what you're talking about. All right. Well, let's wrap this up so you can get to the gym.
Cool. And then we are figuring out, I think our podcast quality is better than what it's been. We need to figure a few more things out with regards to getting other people on the show and maintaining this quality. But then we're going to have Kurt Harris on here. We're going to get the Kraken back on. John Wellborn will be back. We'll get Chris Kresser back. And I know we had a couple other folks in queue that we're going to get on the show. And then also the podcast transcripts will be out soon as well.
Hot damn.
Cool.
All right, Robert.
All right, on G. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, see ya.
Bye.